Welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. This is episode 16. I'm your host, Alan Wolin. When Roger Waters wrote that song for Pink Floyd in 1979, he was probably rebelling against a conservative and rigid form of schooling, which was more about keeping kids in line than educating them. At least that's probably how Waters saw it at the time. Little did we know back then that only 40 years later, our school system would come under the control of a radically different philosophy. That's the subject of today's discussion. In episode 14, we listened to a 1993 interview with Thomas Sowell about his book, Inside American Education. In episode 15, I summarized the first three chapters of the book and interviewed elementary school teacher Ramona Bessinger about whether or not the observations made by Sowell match her 23 years' experience as a teacher. In this episode, I'd like to talk about Chapter 4 of the book, which Sowell calls Assorted Dogmas, and to talk about some of the dogmas which Sowell identified as prevalent in American education back in 1993. I think you'll find this discussion interesting for three reasons. Number one is that Sowell does a fantastic job teasing out the key dogmas which dominate American education. Number two, all of these dogmas are still with us today, almost 30 years later, and it's helpful to know what they are and how they still impact our schools. Number three, I'll be joined later in the show by three very special public school teachers from around the country who are well-versed in these issues, so you'll get to hear some diverse perspectives on the subject. But before I discuss these dogmas, I'd like to talk a little bit about this podcast itself and how it's been doing so far. Our first episode was published in August 2021, about 7 months ago. Since then, we've released 15 episodes, and this is the 16th. I've learned a lot about podcasting in those 7 months, and I'd like to share with you some of the things I've learned. I'd also like to share the statistics of this podcast and how it compares to other podcasts. Let's start with the stats. Here's an overview. As of April 1st, 2022, all the episodes of the podcast have been downloaded 42,765 times. This is an average of 2,851 downloads per episode. 79% of our listeners are in the United States, while 9% are in Canada, Britain, and Australia combined. The remaining 12% are in Europe, Asia, Africa, and South America. I do get emails from all over the world, by the way. What's interesting about the world of podcasting is that it's very hard to figure out what other podcasts are doing in terms of downloads and listener statistics. These numbers are not public. And as far as I know, I'm the only podcaster who is sharing my exact numbers. This podcast is hosted by a company called Buzzsprout, which is one of the largest hosting sites. And Buzzsprout provides overall platform statistics about all the podcasts they host. According to those platform statistics, this podcast ranks approximately in the top 3% of all podcasts on their site. I've put together a document with graphs and charts which summarizes all the statistics of this show. And there's a link in the show notes to that document if you're interested in seeing all the numbers. I will update this document with every new episode, so the numbers there will change each month. I'm not sure how new people are finding the podcast, but I suspect it's a combination of searching the name Thomas Sowell in the various podcast directory apps like Apple Podcast or Spotify, as well as word-of-mouth recommendations from existing listeners. I also feel that the thousands of post-it notes we've sent out all over the world are bringing in new listeners as well. Each post-it note features a different Thomas Sowell quote and also has a QR code, which takes people to TomSowell.com and also to this podcast. A random Sowell post-it note seen by a new person in a random place has the potential to put that person's intellectual life on a whole new trajectory. When someone sees a Sowell quote for the first time, they might be intrigued. Who is this guy anyway? Then they'll do a little research, wonder why they never heard of him before, then hopefully read just one book, at which point they will probably be hooked. As we've discussed in episode 9, reading Sowell is like taking the intellectual red pill. Once you've taken the pill, it's impossible to go back to not knowing you're living inside the Matrix.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
I get lots of emails from people asking how they can support the show. Right now, the best way is to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Give us a 5-star rating if you feel we deserve that, and put a few words into a review if you feel moved to do so. Also, continue to tell friends and family about Thomas Sowell and his ideas. I'd rather people read Sowell's books than listen to this podcast, but of course, there's no reason you can't do both. My goal is for the podcast to become a venue for Sowell students from around the world to come together to discuss his ideas. And, by the way, if you want to be on this show, I have an easy way for you to do that. If you want to ask a question or make a comment about something discussed here, just record your comment or question on the Voice Memos app of your phone and email it to me. I'll play your recorded question or comment on a later episode and discuss your views. What do you have to lose? Before I started my own podcast, I sent in recorded questions to the Alan Dershowitz and Dinesh D'Souza podcasts, and they both played my recordings and answered my questions. It was a real rush to hear my voice on those two world-class podcasts, and I think, in a way, it planted the seed for me to do my own podcasting. The journey of 1,000 miles always begins with one step. I'll put links in the show notes to the audio clips of the two questions which got featured on the Dershowitz and D'Souza podcasts, in case you're curious what I asked. The last thing I want to mention before I get to the dogmas of Chapter 4 of the book is that beginning April 1st, we're charging for the Sowell Post-it notepads. Up until now, we've been mailing them out completely for free, no charge for the pads or for the postage and handling. Now that the show is becoming larger, it's becoming more and more work mailing them out, not to mention the cost of printing the pads, the envelopes, and the postage itself. So starting now, we'll be charging $3 per pad, which includes postage to anywhere in the world. It's still a good deal, and I promise you, the 50 Sowell quotes in each pad will give you hours of enjoyment and a great way to spark deep conversations with friends and family. I recently had a listener purchase 50 pads. Here's what she emailed me. I'll have my wife read this one.
I just listened to your podcast, Sowell and the American Education System, Part 1. Brilliant. I passed it on to my 2 text string groups and got a few people to listen to it. I look forward to Part 2. Claudia. P.S. I posted all the post-it notes in my home office against black paper and have been discussing them with my 3 kids, 6th grade, 6th grade, and 5th grade. Graphically stunning. More importantly, the quotes are on point. I'd love nothing more than to send these to a few of my teacher friends, but I don't think they are ready. P.P.S. What would it cost to order 50 of these post-it notes? I'll pay for it, and I'd like to pass them on to my like-minded friends.
So I sent her the 50 pads, and here's what she wrote back.
I received the post-it notes. Thanks for getting them out to me right away. I've been handing them out to like-minded friends. I've given out 25, and I have 12 more reserved for the coming 2 weeks. They are the best and have prompted a handful of really great conversations. Some people knew Thomas Sowell and some didn't, but everyone loves the common sense quotes. Thanks again, Claudia.
To me, the most amazing thing about Claudia's email is that she has 25 like-minded friends. Wow. I'll have what she's having.
Yes! Yes! Oh! 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 Oh, God! Oh, I'll have what she's having.
So that's my pitch for the Sowell Post-it Notes. They really are tremendous fun. Oh, and by the way, there's a link in the show notes to the designs of all 50 Sowell quotes. Feel free to download them, print them, hang them on your refrigerator door, whatever you want. They're all yours. Now, onto the dogmas of Chapter 4 of Thomas Sowell's book, Inside American Education. After I present the dogmas identified by Sowell in the chapter, I'm going to be joined by a panel of three well-known public school teachers to discuss these dogmas with me. I'll introduce our teachers after my summary. Let's start by defining the word dogma, because it's a word that most of us sort of know, but might have trouble specifically defining. According to Oxford and Merriam-Webster, a dogma is a principle or set of principles laid down by an authority as incontrovertibly true. Dogma is a belief or set of beliefs that is accepted by the members of a group without being questioned or doubted. In Chapter 4, Sowell identifies six widespread dogmas which dominate the mainstream thinking in American education. Let's go through them one by one. Number one is the principle which Sowell calls multicultural diversity. Sowell explains that the definition of multicultural diversity is an amorphous one, which undergoes constant chameleon-like changes. It certainly is a very nice-sounding phrase, and it conjures up images of interesting people and cuisines from all parts of the world coming together in one place to exchange recipes and ideas. Sowell identifies four components of the multicultural diversity doctrine, which go way beyond that, however. The first is an agenda of separatism in language and culture. The second is a revisionist view of history as a collection of grievances to be kept alive. The third is a general condemnation of American society and Western culture. The fourth is the belief that students should adopt a particular set of beliefs rather than develop the tools for coming to their own conclusions. About this latter point, Sowell says this.
The real educational problem is the attempt to impose such views as a new orthodoxy throughout the educational system, not only by classroom brainwashing, but also by institutional power, expressed in such things as compulsory indoctrination programs for teachers, making adherence to multiculturalism a condition of employment, and buying only those textbooks which reflect multiculturalism in some way, even if these are textbooks in mathematics or science.
Interesting. When I hear this quote, it reminds me so much of the current day so-called anti-racism movement. And I wonder if anti-racism is simply a repackaging and rebranding of the older multiculturalism which Sowell was discussing 30 years ago. Here's another quote from the book, which sounds like it was written today. When you are listening to this quote, just mentally replace the word multicultural with anti-racism, and I think it will ring a bell.
Multiculturalists themselves are quite clear that they do not see their philosophy as just one of many philosophies that different people may entertain, or as something to be optional in some parts of the school curriculum. Multicultural perspectives should infuse the entire curriculum, pre-kindergarten through grade 12, emphasis in the original, according to the official report to the New York State Commissioner of Education, because this report considered commitment to multicultural social studies education to be crucial, it called for extensive staff development, which would address attitudes, that is, indoctrination, and which would extend even to the school's clerical staffs and bus drivers. In short, the call for cultural diversity is a call for ideological conformity.
Of course, this isn't how multicultural diversity is presented by its adherents. According to Sowell, it is sold to the public with the following four rationale. Number one, multiculturalism is necessary to enable students to participate in the global economy. Number two, our increasingly diverse society requires education in a variety of cultures. Number three, Intergroup relations are better when people are familiar with each other's cultures. And number four, education itself is better when presented from various cultural perspectives. Sowell goes on to say that none of these four arguments is supported by empirical evidence, and that there is much evidence which argues against them. For example, Japan is an example of a monocultural society which performs quite well in the global economy, in international scientific and technological developments, as well as in travel and tourism. Japan is doing just fine, apparently, without a multicultural agenda. Sowell spends quite a few pages in this chapter on one example of multicultural diversity programs, which was very much in fashion in the early 90s, that of bilingual education. The theory behind bilingual education is that children who do not understand English can best be taught all school subjects in their native language while taking English classes on the side. I have to confess, I know almost nothing about bilingual education, so I looked up what's going on today in Los Angeles, and I discovered that this practice is alive and well here. Nowadays, it's called dual language education, or, even more euphemistically, dual immersion instead of bilingual. As Sowell has pointed out in many contexts, these types of programs tend to change their names over the years as the public begins to associate the names of older programs with negative outcomes. Sort of like when that failing restaurant in your neighborhood gets a new name and an under new management banner on the facade. Here's what I found. In Los Angeles in 2022, there are a total of 187 bilingual programs, 158 in Spanish, 13 in Korean, 10 in Mandarin, 4 in Armenian, 1 in French, and 1 in Arabic. So 85% of the 187 total programs are bilingual Spanish-English programs. I'll put a link in the show notes to the document which lists all these programs, so you can see all the details. The key point that Sowell makes about bilingual programs is not whether or not they provide a good way to transition non-English speaking students into an English language school system. If that were the main goal, it would be relatively easy to try different approaches in different places and compare the academic results to see which ones work best. But according to Sowell, the bilingual movement instead spurred legions of ethnic activists to develop a whole other political and ideological agenda. This agenda promotes both the study and praise of other cultures, as well as a sense of historic grievances against American society in particular and Western society in general. Sowell says this.
While the rationale for so-called bilingual programs has been presented to the public in terms of the educational needs of children whose native language is not English, what actually happens in such programs bears little relationship to that rationale. It bears much more relationship to the careers and ideologies of bilingual activists.
I don't want to talk too much more about the bilingual movement here. Let me just say that it's a whole discussion unto itself, and if you're really interested in it, I suggest taking a deep dive into Chapter 4. Sowell reveals many quite surprising details there. As always, follow the money trail, and it will explain a lot. As Sowell says, quote, bilingualism has been aptly described as a jobs program for Spanish-speaking teachers, end quote. This topic reveals an interesting point about the special vulnerability of education to being hijacked by ideological activists. Sowell says this.
The political success of bilingual activists, despite the opposition of parents and teachers, and despite both scholarly studies and journalistic exposés revealing the fraudulence of their claims, has wider implications for the vulnerability of the political process to strident special interests who are organized and ruthless. Education at all levels is especially vulnerable to promoters of their own ideological or financial interests in the name of some group for whom they claim to speak.
Sowell takes issue with the multiculturalists' argument that intergroup relations are better when people are familiar with each other's cultures. Sowell makes the point that this belief is not supported by the evidence, and that, in fact, the evidence points in the opposite direction, which is that multiculturalism in schools actually makes racism worse. Sowell says this,
"Promoters of so-called bilingual education, like the promoters of other forms of separatism, often claim that they are promoting intergroup harmony and mutual respect. Language diversity within a society reduces ethnocentrism, one such promoter claims. But it would be hard to find concrete examples of this anywhere on this planet. While there are all too many counterexamples of nations torn apart by ethnic polarization in Malaysia, murderous riots in India, and outright civil war in Sri Lanka, to name just a few. Sri Lanka is an especially poignant example, for it was at one time justly held up to the world as a model of intergroup harmony, before language politics became a major issue."
The second dogma Sowell discusses is that of so-called sensitivity. We are often told that we must become more sensitive to various ethnic, linguistic, sexual, or lifestyle groups. And to be truly sensitive, we must not only accept other people's way of life, we must affirm and even celebrate them. And that this requirement of sensitivity is valid in only one direction. As Sowell says,
"What is even more absurd, the sensitivity argument is not even consistent because everything changes drastically according to who is A and who is B. Those in the chosen groups may repudiate any aspect of the prevailing culture without being considered insensitive, but no one from the prevailing culture may repudiate any aspect of other cultures."
The third dogma discussed by Sowell is that of the idea of relevance. The notion that students must be taught in a way the students feel is relevant to their particular culture and circumstances. Sowell says this,
"The relevance argument becomes especially dangerous when it is used to justify teaching different things to students from different racial or ethnic groups on the basis of those students' immediate emotional responses or their uninformed sense of plausibility as to what might, for example, be relevant to the black experience at a time of life when they do not have enough experience of any color to make such a determination."
Subjects must not only be adapted to what students feel is relevant to them. They must also be adapted to make them relevant to the dominant ideological vision. Sowell gives the example of China during the Cultural Revolution, during which traditional academic criteria were subordinated to other social goals, such as the abolition of elitism and group representation. College entrance exams were abolished. Grades were no longer assigned by teachers, but were negotiated with students, and off-campus activities could substitute for academic work. Sowell points out how this led to the 20-year decline of academic performance throughout China. Sowell then compares China to the U.S. when he says,
"The biggest difference between China's educational experiments and those in the United States has been that the Chinese learned from their mistakes and abandoned such policies, while American education continues on the same course. Chinese political leaders recognized that China was falling further behind world standards in science and technology as a result of its educational debacles, and proceeded to reintroduce the teaching of traditional subjects and college entrance examinations. Ideologically defined relevance was no longer a sacred cow in China, though it remains so in the United States."
The fourth dogma Sowell describes is the notion of educating the whole person. This is also called child-centered education, which sounds terrific. This is the idea of an education which is tailored to the social background and psychology of each student. This is one of Sowell's funniest sections of the book. He made me laugh several times while reading it. Sowell talks about the overly ambitious nature of such an approach and expresses his doubts that such tailor-made education is even possible. In one of the best quotes from the book, he says this:
that educators who have repeatedly failed to do what they are hired to do and trained to do should take on sweeping roles as amateur psychologists, sociologists, and social philosophers seems almost inexplicable, except that they are doing it with other people's money and experimenting on other people's children.
And Sowell really made me laugh with this gem.
Educational theory too often focuses on the desirability of doing something, to the complete exclusion of the question of our capability of doing it. No doubt it would be far more desirable to travel through the air like Superman instead of inching along in a traffic jam, but that is no reason to leap off skyscrapers. Our educational system is full of the results of leaping off skyscrapers.
According to Sowell, the notion of child-centered education is simply another form of camouflage for the ideological indoctrination of children at the expense of academic learning. Sowell says this:
the whole person philosophy is not simply a theory of education. It has become an open floodgate through which all sorts of non-educational activities have poured into the schools, relieving many teachers of the drudgery of teaching and substituting more exciting world-saving crusades in place of the development of academic skills.
The fifth dogma presented by Sowell is the idea that students must have role models from the same social background as themselves, and that students are taught more effectively by people of the same race, ethnicity, culture, and sex as themselves. Firstly, Sowell points out that those who support the role model dogma have a vested self-interest in promoting it as a way to guarantee themselves jobs in the various bilingual, ethnic, and feminist studies programs. Sowell also offers a powerful insight about the administrators who go along with this idea and what motivates them to do so. He says this:
administrators who have caved in to demands for various enclaves and preserves for particular groups likewise have a vested interest in this dogma as a defense against critics. Around this solid core of supporters of the role model idea, there is a wider penumbra of those who wish to be au courant with the latest buzzwords, or to be on the side of the angels, as currently defined.
After all, who among us doesn't want to be au courant with latest ideological trends? Sowell once again gives the example of the all-black Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C., and how it achieved stellar academic results with no Afrocentric curriculum, and even taught Latin long after most American schools had abandoned it. He also gives the example of the all-black high school in New Orleans called St. Augustine's, which was founded and staffed by all whites. In short, Sowell makes the argument that there is no empirical evidence to validate the belief that students being taught by teachers from their own background make any difference whatsoever in academic outcomes. The sixth dogma presented by Sowell is the notion that self-esteem is a precondition for effective learning. For Sowell, this is a great lesson in how to confuse cause and effect. He makes me laugh when he says this:
like so much that comes out of that philosophy, it confuses cause and effect. No doubt valedictorians feel better about themselves than do students who have failed numerous courses, just as people who have won the Nobel Prize probably have more self-esteem than people who have been convicted of a felony. Outside the world of education, few would be confident or even comfortable claiming that it is a lack of self-esteem which leads to felonies, or its presence which leads to Nobel Prizes. Yet American schools are permeated with the idea that self-esteem precedes performance, rather than vice versa. The very idea that self-esteem is something earned, rather than being a prepackaged handout from the school system, seems not to occur to many educators. Too often, American educators are like the Wizard of Oz, handing out substitutes for brains, bravery, or heart.
The quest to protect students' self-esteem has led to grade inflation, the abolition of failing grades, and the watering down of standards, according to Sowell. It has the added benefit of making teachers' jobs easier and enabling them to focus less on academics and more on ideological issues. As Sowell says,
"The self-esteem doctrine is just one in a long line of educational dogmas used to justify or camouflage a historic retreat from academic education."
So those are the six main educational dogmas presented by Sowell in Chapter 4 of Inside American Education. To summarize, they are 1. Multicultural diversity, 2. Sensitivity, 3. Relevance, 4. Educating the whole person, 5. Role models, and 6. Self-esteem. Now that I've summarized the chapter for you, I'd like to bring on the show our panel of distinguished public school teachers to discuss these ideas with me and with each other. Our first teacher is Ramona Bessinger, who you will remember from episode 15. Ramona is a 23-year tenured public school teacher in Providence, Rhode Island, who most recently taught English to elementary school students. Our second teacher is Frank McCormick. Frank has been teaching history for over a decade at Waukegan High School and Loyola Academy in Illinois. He is the founder of a website called Chalkboard Heresy, which seeks to bring light to the dangers posed by critical social justice theories in schools. Our third teacher is Tony Kinnett. Tony was a public school science teacher in Indianapolis, as well as a school administrator. He was fired from both of those positions for speaking out in opposition to an educational agenda which he feels is harmful to his students. He is also the founder of the Chalkboard Review, which is a website dedicated to featuring a diverse range of voices on all topics education-related. I'll put links in the show notes to each of our three panelists so you can find out more about them. Ramona, Frank, and Tony, welcome to the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So I sent you all chapter 4 of Thomas Sowell's book, Inside American Education, because I'd like to focus on the themes of that chapter on this episode. And I wanted to start by talking about the dogma, which Sowell refers to as multicultural diversity. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Frank, why don't you go first?
I was struck kind of by the similarities that Sowell used in his language about describing it as an orthodoxy and as a dogma, because that's kind of the same language I've kind of leaned on just from my own experience. I think with multicultural diversity, what I found kind of interesting is there's this kind of contradiction between what is espoused as a value, which is diversity and multiculturalism, and then the kind of reality of these institutions, which are anything but diverse in terms of kind of intellectual discourse or curriculum. It's very rigid and dogmatic and ideological. And so they kind of espouse multiculturalism as this catch-all for their ideology, and espousing what they like about certain cultures and kind of picking, cherry picking, I guess, those elements and infusing them into their kind of ideological program.
Do you feel that this concept of multicultural diversity is still being pushed in the schools? Like, do they use that terminology or has it morphed into something else?
It's kind of been overtaken by this idea of inclusion, which I think is a more aggressive form of diversity. It's not just diversity, kind of is just a descriptor. And yes, you have DEI departments where diversity is kind of at their head, but inclusion is really this new thing where it's like forcefully including marginalized cultures into the curriculum or into the program, and to make it this idea of a welcoming space for historically marginalized and oppressed groups.
Yeah, I think that within that so it sounds so good to build a structure that you're going to assist and help marginalized groups. And so what kept hitting me repeatedly through the chapter was how it has to be marketed. and how it sounds really good. And you go into detail on how great it's packaged together. And something that Frank and I have discussed quite a bit in our conversations regarding Soul, and from multiculturalism all the way to its new, as you said, substituting in anti-racism for the new term, it's packaged so beautifully. It's such a wonderful thing that no one would ever have any issues with. And it never produces the data. And as soon as people start to realize that it's time to maybe reckon it with the results, they change the name and they move to the next social purity dogma aspect of, it's really great, you just have to trust us. And it's amazing how, you know, Soul was writing about these things back in the 70s and the 80s about multiculturalism and into the early 90s. And now we're seeing this yet again, the exact same regurgitation packaged in the same pretty wrapping paper. And it's heartbreaking because of who it's being experimented on and who's bearing the brunt of those results. And especially with, you know, Frank and I seeing how a lot of these different cultures react inside of schools. And of course, Ramona seeing it as well in her over 20 years of teaching. It's wild how quickly these kids are bent around these moral posturings. It's sickening.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you thinking about starting a podcast, launching a YouTube channel, or repurposing your old blog content? Then I have the podcast just for you. Hi, I'm Crystal Proffitt, host of the Proffitt Podcast. And as a content creator, I know firsthand what it's like to feel confused and overwhelmed with everything you could or should be doing. So join us every week as we strip down those processes and take all of that overwhelm away. We'll talk about the strategies I use to help creators start, launch, and market their content with confidence. If that sounds like something you're on board with, then click the link in the show notes and follow the Proffitt Podcast today.
Yeah. And just to sort of speak to that point, what I'm seeing in my school, you know, I teach in a predominantly non-white community, urban community. And, you know, children developmentally, as you know, will sort of, one, they want to please, they're at a developmental stage where they're exploring different identities and different ways of proving themselves in the world. And so really this whole agenda is taking advantage of, you know, youth in our communities. And it is sad. It's very sad because, you know, just to sort of talk to the idea of this notion of multiculturalism and multiculturalism diversity, it is really a fallacy, you know, and it's a way to create, I think, a certain amount of buy-in, because you can't have a movement or a political ideology that you want people to believe just because it's so. You have to have some sort of buy-in. So this idea that there is this two-tiered society that we live in is that, you know, is the buy-in for the kids anyway.
Well, and, it's also, yeah. I mean, just to add to that really quick, he says in the very beginning that it conjures up images of everyone sharing recipes and music, and we're all coming together to give each other these big hugs. And like, we've created this beautiful melting pot, when instead it does the exact opposite.
That's right. It does. It's divisive. And it's, in fact, creating such aggression amongst the students, especially towards me in school. I mean, it's alarming. I have, it's no secret. I'm in a basement at a high school. They've sort of tucked me away to keep me out of keep me away from the student population, the classroom, et cetera. But kids have been trickling down and coming down to see me. Some are quietly, you know, expressing concern for the same things, while others are openly hostile. And in particular, just recently, there was a transgender student who's displayed such hostility at, he could not believe that I was opposed to these sort of these political ideologies and ideas and notions, like, you know, so this whole idea of diversity, it does not exist. You're only able to be, you know, you're only respected as the notion of diversity is only respected so long as you embrace this sort of political orthodoxy, you know, or the ideology. Otherwise, it's you're confronted with hostility.
Well, look at the functionality of things such as multiculturalism, diversity, this idea of racism in schools, the functionality that it serves for school districts, I think explains why they get behind it, is because out of public education's failure, it provides a convenient kind of reason for that failure.
Absolutely.
And then it provides kind of a missionary drive. So why have schools failed? Well, they're not diverse enough. Scapegoats one group. White teachers are to blame for kind of the failure to diversify education and to teach in a way that they call culturally competent. And then we have this great new calling that has threads of moralism intertwined. And that calling is to, you know, be culturally relevant and connect with the kids. And it also kind of lionizes and romanticizes elements of their culture that I think are gross simplifications. You know, the idea of certain things in Hispanic, or they'd say Latinx, or whatever you call it now, Latinx. they broadly make characterizations that Latinx culture is X, Y, and Z. I'm trying to think of an example. It's very family oriented, as if other cultures aren't family oriented. And therefore, if we do things that center around the family, it'll connect to them in a way that white culture doesn't. And then they make certain assumptions about white culture, that it's driven by desire of money over family. I mean, it's all just
stereotyping.
You know, speaking of multicultural agenda, Sowell talks a lot. He spends a lot of pages in chapter four talking about bilingual education. And this is something I knew, or probably still know, very, very little about. It was not something I was exposed to growing up. And I'm wondering if that's still a thing. I mean, is bilingual education, from your experiences, still a big push in the school system?
Huge where I was. Now, I taught in a school district that was maybe 90% Hispanic, and a lot of first and second gen Americans. So there may have been a legitimate function to having some type of bilingual program. But what I started to notice is there was no path out, and it often became a path in.
That's
for
right.
Native born students who were taking bilingual education. And it didn't really seem to serve its kind of, it kind of became this limbo where kids will get stuck. And, you know, the emphasis, I don't think, was always necessarily on becoming competent in English. It was developing dual languages, because both are equally important and the same. I mean, I understand that, you know, the community where I taught, it was predominantly Hispanic, and you had a lot of native Spanish speakers, but it was revealing that where they put their time and energy and resources, not into educating the community to speak English and how to become competent in English. You know, they didn't focus on adult education for parents or those types of resources. It was all about accommodation, which they felt was compassionate.
I mean, that's just the best way to say it. It's this idea of faux compassion. And as someone who is fluent in Spanish, in speaking and in writing and in listening, I also spent a lot of my time through my graduate programs at Ball State University, really working on STEM lab environments. And I was encouraged quite often, and they didn't even know that I spoke Spanish, but I was encouraged to put a lot of my time and effort into developing Hispanic-centric STEM labs. And the reason was because in the United States, the majority of people who go into STEM programs are white males. Now, it also happens that young boys are most often captivated by young engineering-style problems and naturally go into things that they can make move and blow up. That's just how young boys are. And that because the white population of the United States is the cultural normative, it's what you're going to see most often walking down any street in the country, that data fits as kind of a natural expression, but that's not really what's brought to bear, of course, as Sowell describes in his excerpts on multiculturalism in this chapter, which is that it must be some innate, you know, we're not speaking Spanish in our STEM labs. That's why there aren't more Hispanic students in STEM classes. You know, we're not making it more accessible to them. And so I was encouraged, and even in private graduate studies, I was recruited by a Dr. Ding out of Indiana University to develop a Hispanic set of labs for a larger Hispanic community population in Anderson. And I was actually kicked off of that doctoral research study, and this was in 2018, because my results found that it was more useful for the students to be taught English through the labs than to make the labs Spanish-centric, because it's also crippling their families. When I was at Lawrence North in Indianapolis, I would do my best to encourage my Hispanic students who would be primarily Spanish speaking to grasp English in my classroom, because that's going to serve them much more in our economy and in the growing world economy than Spanish ever could. And that's a harsh reality.
It is a harsh reality, and one that doesn't sound very popular, but it's actually true. If you look at how language is acquired, it's not acquired by, you know, providing special instruction. English is not my first language. I learned English by being immersed in a classroom with, you know, with other English speaking students and in a culture that was completely English. There's no data to show that children will learn better if they're taught in their native language, or if we are somehow warm and fuzzy about our lesson planning and introducing all of these culturally responsive ideas and whatnot. There's zero data to support that. And yet there's a big push for that. In Providence, for example, the Department of Justice has sort of intervened and come into Providence to say, basically now, that we all need to be English as a second language certified. Why is that? There's zero data to show that children will learn better, that they'll do, boys will do better, girls will do better in math and science and English. Nothing. It's all complete fairies and snowflakes. You know, it's like it's completely made up to sort of push this, what I think is, you know, this sort of Marxist new world order that they're trying to introduce. And it's also a way to dismantle the current system, right? Because if you make it so that teachers must have an English as a second language certification or a dual language certification, well, that's simply not possible for a lot of teachers. So you have this mass exodus now out of the system. Well, guess what? Now we have the governor of Rhode Island and the Department of Education saying, oh my goodness, all these teachers have left because they don't want to get this English as a second language certification. We need to bring in diverse teachers from Europe and from Central America, and teachers of color, especially now that we've created this vacuum. That's the agenda behind this sort of bilingual education and English second language. It has nothing to do with serving this population of non-English speaking students. And as an English teacher and French teacher, and understanding exactly how language is acquired, it's a complete and utter lie.
Absolutely. That's why Seoul calls it a jobs program back in, you know, we actually have started moving away from our, especially in elementary schools, we've moved away from our elementary teachers having a requirement to be competent in their subjects. When I taught middle school science, I would get students who had no idea of any fundamental aspect of science or math because their teachers didn't like it, but their teachers could speak Spanish. And that was more important to the administration, that they had some kind of faux sheen of multiculturalism in their classroom, rather than teaching their skills the functional competencies that are required for all three of us to be functional members of society and education, much less in the trades, in the community, in civics and politics, and the list goes on and on.
That's very true. You look at when you apply for a job, like for example, in the Lake County School Consortium near me, and the majority of the questions are not centered around your expertise as a historian or in academics. It's about how do you celebrate diversity? It's about how would you make your classroom inclusive? That is what they're screening for. And that, as a result, is what they get. Teachers that are big on fluff and big on sheen and not much else.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
911, what's your emergency?
Hi, Lita!
I'm Kane Princeton.
Not Dr. Princeton. I am done with counseling. That's it.
This is a story about Mylena Hendrick, a corporate accountant at war with her enemies.
You are pathetic!
Depression.
Mylena, I love you.
And anxiety.
Connie, come back to me.
Mylena, everything will work out.
She needs a man.
I don't want to do this.
Sometimes the hardest thing about life is living life. Living life.
Listen to The Accountant and the Counselor wherever you get your podcast.
That's correct.
I'll speak as a homeschooling parent. My wife and I homeschool our four daughters, 3, 5, 8, and 10 years old. And one of the reasons, and we've been doing this since the very beginning, not pandemic related. And one of the reasons was we felt that when you send your children to school, you have no idea about the competence of the teachers? There's no way to know. Their SAT scores are not posted anywhere. Their grades in college are not posted anywhere. You basically trust the brand of the school. Hmm. And it seems like that is a very shoddy foundation for deciding to put your kids in a certain school, because these teachers could be, to a large extent, you know, incompetent in the field that you are hoping for them to inspire your children in.
That's correct. I would agree.
Yeah. And a lot of them are incompetent. I mean, just.
Yeah.
The standards are so low at these schools. In my first 2 years teaching at Knightstown Intermediate School in Eastern Central Indiana, I was the buildings teacher of the year. How? I was fresh out of college. Was it because I was some phenomenal educator come down from the heavens? No, I was a very passionate, fiery young teacher who had a competent grasp of his subject matter and who had spent 10 years in youth ministry developing good, solid pedagogy and how to relate difficult concepts to children. So when you combine the two and you put them in, you put me in a mediocre public school environment, of course, it's not difficult to excel in a field of mediocrity. And so you're 100% correct. And this is why, like you, my wife and I are seeking to homeschool our family, because I don't want to have to trust someone who I can't verify isn't mediocre. Because how do you verify someone's competence, someone's lack of mediocrity, by going after the brand? And certainly a brand that hasn't proved itself in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
That's right. Exactly. But that is, in fact, what's happening in our schools. Teachers who are the new teachers coming in are there more, you know, administrators are more concerned with teachers that are willing to advance all of these, you know, notions of gender theory, this race-based curriculum. These are the questions that you get asked on in interviews. Not what your skill set, what you can bring academically to students, how you can raise the bar for students academically. In fact, that would be met with, well, that's racist, you know, to set the bar high or to set academic standards for students. It's really horrible what is happening. I mean, I'm sure that all of us are on this panel. It's frightening.
Ramon is correct, and it really is frightening. And a clear example of this for me is when we were interviewing a position, we were creating a position above me between my first and second year at Indianapolis to have a math and science director, which they were going to call the STEM director. That's a whole other ball of wax for another time. But in her interview, we never brought up the fact that this individual who would become my new boss, we never brought up that she'd never taught a science class, yet she would be the director of math and science for 33,000 students. It was never brought up, but we'd spent endless amounts of time on, well, what if one of your workers has a child who is transgender? What if one of your, you know, what if one of your teachers is struggling with a racial issue at their school? What if this? And I remember thinking, aren't these the common sense questions that should be assumed? And the content is what we should reassure ourselves of? And it wasn't. It wasn't brought up once.
Seems like a very therapeutic agenda. Let me ask you a question. Tony, you mentioned that you have children.
I do.
And Ramona, I know you've mentioned that you have children. Frank, do you have children?
Yes.
Okay, so all three of you have children. I have children, obviously. I have this theory, and I wanted to just run it by you. This is not something from Sowell's chapter, but while the subject of teachers having children has come up, do you feel that there's an increasing percentage of the teacher population that is childless, that is now dominating the schools? Now, the reason I bring this up is Mark Stein wrote a fantastic book that has always stuck in my mind for years and years. And he talks about how almost all of Europe's leaders, their presidents, their prime ministers, are childless. And I thought that that was a phenomenal observation, that Europe is now being run by childless people. In other words, people who do not really have skin in the game,
right,
called the future. You know, the life ends with them, because they have chosen not to have children. And I'm wondering if this phenomenon is also going on in our schools.
Without a doubt. This is, for goodness gracious, what an important point to bring up that Sowell points to in most of his writings. There's this common, very prevalent idea in Generation Z and Generation I Alpha following them today that the world needs to be run by young people. I disagree. I think that the world needs to be run by parents, because parents have the experience to not make stupid decisions in policy most of the time. They're more guarded, perhaps, than your average teenager at making a big life decision. But they also have children who they are building the next generation for. So when I am designing education policy, when I'm designing curriculum, I am designing something that I hope will enrich my child so that they have a better chance at making the world we want to see. And in schools, we see countless teachers coming into the profession who are young, who have no interest in having any children. And the only reason that they are entering the profession is to have an amount of worship and affirmation for their lifestyle choice by students, by young people. So many, and Frank knows, I call them mommy teachers, that want nothing more than to be these faux parents to be worshipped. They aren't real parents. They have no idea what raising a family is about, the sacrifices that need to be made, the focus on character and on feeding the child good things and not just trash. It's really a huge issue in schools, and it's something that's not talked about enough.
And it's unfortunate because there's no better person than a parent to really understand the developmental needs of a child. And, you know, if anybody has young children, I have four. So my kids span the ages of 16 to 25 right now. But I understand very well how horribly embarrassed my own children would be at some of the things that are being presented in the classroom. But if you take a child that may not come from a home where there's two parents or even one parent, then they're vulnerable to pleasing that adult in front of them. And if that adult doesn't have children, then they have no understanding how to relate. In some cases, may even be pedophiles. Sorry to say, but that's the reality. And now you have these sort of barriers that have broken down in the schools. And that is why, you know, parents are so up in arms, where, you know, anyone who's a parent or a teacher parent is just horrified at all of this, because we're seeing these very, very young, as you say, Tony, mommy teachers who seem more concerned with, you know, garnishing the sort of adoration of the students rather than, you know, teaching and educating. And it's a real problem. It truly is, because veteran teachers like myself are not respected. They want us out of the schools. And the new teachers coming in are very, very young. And then often we're seeing these teachers from Teach for America. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this organization, but it's part of the whole dismantling of education.
They often refer to their students as our kids, mm-hmm. our children.
Yep. Spot on.
Or my kids. And I think that's very revealing. And in doing that, they kind of assume all the ownership with none of the responsibility. And they do what they feel are the important parts without the difficult parts. I mean, you know, to them, the important parts are instilling values, their ideology, but they don't also have to bear any responsibility for the direction those go. So it's kind of a classic moral hazard in a way, you know, where they're not on the line for any of the liability of what they're quote unquote investing in.
That's a great point. It's a difference between Mr. Feeny in Boy Meets World and the teachers in Glee, the show. So the teachers in Glee act a lot like a lot of teachers do now. It's kind of a weird blueprint. And in a lot of education programs that I've spoken with over the last decade, in the last 2 or 3 years specifically, I have a lot of students and professors citing that they want to be teachers like off the show Glee, which is incredibly specific, but it's too common. It's because these teachers, like Frank said, they want all of the praise, they want all of the fun, all of those life-affirming moments with their kids without any of the responsibility. Whereas George Feeney, for example, in Boy Meets World, when the main characters would come to him with a problem, he would give them hard, specific truths, and he never budged once. And he was strict, he wasn't always popular, but it was always the right thing for the students' development. And we have lost that in education, sacrificed it for, they're not even momentary gains, they're momentary feelings.
Mm-hmm. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
So how do you live a good life, especially now? Is it about happiness, purpose, love, or friendship? And what about health or wealth? Can you live a good life even if you're struggling? The truth is often not what you think. I'm Jonathan Fields, best-selling author and host of the award-winning Good Life Project podcast. Every week, we bring you revealing conversations with some of the smartest, most accomplished, and yes, sometimes famous people that will awaken insight, arm you with practical tips, and inspire you to live your best life no matter what comes your way. Look for Good Life Project on your favorite podcast app today.
Yeah, it's like a drug. It feels good. You get kids, you know, saying what you want to hear, and you just keep getting these hits of it, and it kind of, becomes a narcissistic reinforcement mechanism. And I saw that with certain teachers, and then it becomes a competition, which teacher's most popular, who's liked, and, becoming surrogate parents. I mean, it was creepy. Kids coming to you with all their problems,
and they're not the problems that you think either. They're not my parents, my dad's an alcoholic. I didn't get that. What I would get is, man, I really wanted her to touch me there, and she didn't when we were kissing. What should I do? And I was one of their weird, creepy English teachers who would affirm them and give them weird personal sexual advice. I found out when I was nearing my end of time at Lawrence. And my response was always, what are you doing touching them? Like, I don't care if you see me as some weird old Puritan strict teacher. This isn't healthy for you. Whether that makes me popular or not shouldn't be my concern, but it is the concern of hundreds of thousands of our teachers.
Yes. Was my concern at the beginning of this year, really quickly, just to speak to that point, students were coming in, maybe one in every class, asking me about what it meant to be pansexual, or what it means to, how can they become, these questions, these very inappropriate questions about the various different types of genders and sexual partners and different, this is in middle school, sixth and seventh grade. So, it's heartbreaking.
Speaking of affirming things, Sowell talks about the second dogma that he mentions is what he calls the relevance dogma, that everything has to be, the students have to feel like everything they're taught is relevant to them, and that everything the teachers teach has to be relevant to the ideological agendas of the day. Well, what are your thoughts on this relevance concept?
I think it's the buy-in, to help kids to feel that they are really contributing to something significant here if they participate in this activism or sort of sexual revolution or gender theories. And it could be that that's part of a motivating of the troops, so to speak.
I think that it more in lies with a child's framing of the problem. So when a junior higher would frame an issue, they go to the lowest hanging fruit, kind of the front red herring right in front of them. I think back to Scooby-Doo, and Fred would always think it was red herring. It was that curly haired red kid. He had to be the problem because he was right there and he didn't like him. And when you look at a group of students in, let's say, the inner city, and there's not a lot of references to inner city culture or classical Black American culture from the various different kinds of classical Black American culture. And I don't mean classical in the Latin sense. I mean, classical is in the early 1900s classic Black culture in the United States. It's an easy scapegoat. Well, the reason they're not learning is because they don't have enough older Black role models. And Thomas Sowell, of course, talks about this a lot in chapter four, but the data doesn't show that. Of course, he compares St. Augustine's, to, of course, the Black high school in DC. And I think that where we are right now in saying that, well, there isn't enough representation, there isn't enough relevance, is a classical, or it's a classic scapegoat, as Frank said earlier. The reason they have to be failing is because there isn't this very easy elementary idea in their lives. We're forcing them to too high of a standard. Really, they can't handle it. They need something that they're familiar with and they're comfortable with, or they're never going to learn. Frank has talked about that for years in a lot of his critiques of the current education system, especially in all aspects of education in Waukesha.
Yeah, the idea of relevance to me is a little confusing because for myself, at least, sometimes what I'm most interested in is what is not relevant at all to my life, what's completely foreign and alien and different, because it intrigues me and it kind of hooks me. This, I don't understand this. I can't relate to this. What is behind it? I was always very interested in, Japanese history precisely because I couldn't relate to it. I couldn't understand what a samurai was, this idea of death being, having a good death and an honorable death, that was very foreign and unrelatable to me. But it was precisely because of that that I found it so intriguing. And then the more you learn and the more you read, the more you kind of organically relate it to certain aspects of your life, but not on first glance. And I think, you know, Sowell talked about this, the idea that how can you know whether something is relatable if you don't know anything about it? Oftentimes you relate to it as you uncover it, but that takes time. And so it's kind of a bad idea to bring that in to pedagogy and to inculcate students into this idea that you should be intrinsically interested in something for it to have any value.
It's also exceptionally stereotypical. So the idea that we would have Hispanic students, well, if you know, we don't talk about Day of the Dead, then they're not going to possibly relate to what we're talking about in my classroom. And that's horrible. I mean, the idea that what my Black students aren't going to, you know, enjoy my home ec class if we don't make fried chicken, anyone and everyone would correctly assume that's a very racist idea. Mm-hmm. And yet we do that in all of our subjects, in all of our public schools today, in how we sort our students. Gloria Ladson-Billings described in 1994 in her essay on culturally relevant teaching as being centered around the student's race. And she was writing that essay in a direct slap to Thomas Sowell because she found it abhorrent that we could look at students as potential individuals who can relate to anything that's put in front of them. Therefore, you put the best substance in front of them. You give them the highest rigor, regardless of the color. You give them the highest and greatest materials. You know, Frank wasn't forced to look at Japanese culture as a child. He found it captivating and invigorating. It wasn't part of a racial quota series. But by doing this dumbing down in the current process, we end up stereotyping and encouraging the very racial separatism that we've worked so hard to get our country out of.
Do you ever notice, too, that it's culturally relevant education for the students of color and multiculturalism for the white students?
Right. No one ever actually talks about Irish history. No one ever talks about Germanic history, unless you're talking about the atrocities of the Third Reich. There is no Germanic history before that point. We don't talk about it. No one ever brings to bear the history of King Arthur or why Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings or Nordic history. It's
a lot of that literature is being removed or reframed to suit this political ideology. So you're right that, you know, even Shakespeare, all of the stories of Shakespeare have been sort of are now being retold at the high school. You know, some of the characters are changed, some of the plots and the theme is changed to sort of bring it to this whole movement that is occurring in education. And you're right, we're not studying the culture and the language and the history. I really feel that we are in many ways erasing reality, or there's an attempt to erase reality and erase history and retell it in a different way. I think it's going to fail, by the way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you only eat brownies, you are going to eventually grow sick of eating brownies. And I remember seeing this when I was watching a high school history teacher at Crispus Attucks at IPS describe the Reconstruction movement. And he was pairing Booker T. Washington against W.E.B. Du Bois. And it was really weird because he was going and trying to make, you know, Du Bois look really great and how he was super radical. And so that was important and all these things. And he was really bashing on Booker T. Washington because he was more of a moderate, more of an integralist, more going towards a colorblind society. But most of his students weren't having it. They were so tired of this weird fat white man in his 30s trying to convince them that white people are all bad and evil and Booker T. Washington was this Uncle Tom. There were students in the back just rolling their eyes constantly at him. And I'm in the room as an administrator. You know, usually students sit up straighter and, you know, there's an administrator in the room. They were so disgusted that my presence in the room meant nothing. That's how fed up they were with being pandered to.
While you were talking, I was thinking about these books that we actually have in our home. It's old fairy tales that are told through a different culture. So we have a book on Rapunzel, and Rapunzel is an Indian, you know, South Asian Indian woman. And it's basically set in a South Asian setting. And I would always feel like, you know, the thing I remembered most from Rapunzel was Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair so I may climb the golden stair, because she had blonde hair. But they've changed the lyrics of the book so that there's no golden stair anymore because her hair is black. And I think that this is, you know, sort of like the removal of white culture in a way. And, you know, Sowell talks about sensitivity, that sensitivity only works in one direction, that the majority has to be sensitive to the minority, but the minority never has to be sensitive to the majority.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's because the majority in the, you know, it's like underdog syndrome. It's the underdog to the left is always the victim, is always in the right. It's kind of this fallacy, assuming that because you're in this, it's like the opposite of the ad populum fallacy. It's like, well, because you're in the minority, because it's a small dissenting view, it must inherently be right. That's a fallacy in and of itself as well. And just because a group has been marginalized or oppressed doesn't mean they have some sacred wisdom or something to teach us. They may not, or they may, I don't know. But yeah, that's, if I think about, it's like the in early anthropology, you had this kind of romanticization that took place of various ethnic groups, that because they had never civilized in the way Europeans had, they must have sacred knowledge. They must be more in touch with nature and God and these true values. And I mean, it's just ridiculous to think that, that they're anything other than people just doing what people do best, which is try and survive. And, you know, maybe the opposite is true. Maybe that we have less to learn from them because they didn't advance to these heights that other civilizations did. I'm not saying that's true, but it's possible.
Let's segue into the last dogma that Sowell talks about in chapter four, which is the self-esteem dogma. That self-esteem is something that teachers should be giving their kids first. And then accomplishment and achievement and academic success will grow out of the soil of self-esteem. And that's a dogma that he presents. What are your thoughts on that?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, host of the UK's number one ranked leadership podcast, The Leadership Enigma. We're helping leaders, their teams and organizations all over the world discover new ways of working to succeed in a world that just won't stop changing. With over 100 episodes already, our guests have included top CEOs, Olympic athletes, undercover police officers, former NBA players, psychologists, New York Times best-selling authors, military commanders, academics, and more. We'd love you to come and join the conversation and be part of the Leadership Enigma community.
Oh, his example was perfect. The example of the student who, the Nobel Prizes, that, well, there's, if you have a Nobel Prize, your self-esteem is probably pretty high. And if you have a felony, your self-esteem is probably pretty low. And it's not the lack of self-esteem that leads to the felony. And it's not the large amount of self-esteem that leads to the Nobel Prize. But how you perform should dictate how you feel about your series of performances, because that's all pseudo-reflective psychology is. And as you know, we've expressed in this entire cast and conversation, the data continually suggests that it is a student's performance that dictates their self-esteem, not the pandering, flippant, hugging mommy teacher nonsense of you are special and valuable because I assign that value to you.
It's also very dangerous, once again. I mean, I don't feel comfortable in, you know, hugging students or validating their feelings. That is not, in fact, my role. My role is to educate and to provide a structured education. That, you know, that sort of nurturing piece should come and should happen at home, right? And unfortunately, teachers are being praised and their sort of evaluations and efficacy is being tied into their ability to connect with students in this way. And it's harmful, dangerous. I would not want a teacher, you know, digging into my child's personal feelings and emotions. I simply don't want that. I don't send my children to go to, you know, to school to have that kind of relationship. There are all kinds of problems associated with that, but yet that is happening in school. And in fact, you know, it's all around me. I mean, I can't.
So funnily enough, George Lucas used to be a big proponent of this concept and this idea. So if you remember in his early writings in episode four, and it's actually what brings it back through the theme of the prequels, is that there was this classical idea that whoever wedged themselves between the child and the parent would lead them away. So this all the way goes back to the mythology around the Pied Piper and coming and playing his tune through town, and the children would follow him out. You see this in Pinocchio, where there's the island of the jackasses, where the boys all go to smoke cigars and get away from their parents. And you see this brought forward in Star Wars, right? Palpatine leads Anakin away from the good and the true by putting himself between Anakin and his parental figure, that being Obi-Wan Kenobi, until you get to the end where all it takes is the suggestion, maybe your parent is wrong, to bring you to the 1930s through the 1970s aspects of fascist and communist culture, in which you are expected to report on your no longer authority figure, but just someone who's expected to do the minimum amount to raise you until they take over. And that's what I don't like about this. It is encouraging children to put incredible amounts of distance between their parents because their parents have no love for them, no authority to help them make decisions, no vision of what might be best for them, no trust to aggregate the data that we all make regarding our families. And it is a wedge driven into the family, which is why we're seeing such a huge flare up in American politics right now. That's why education is pushed to the front of any political issue, because this wedge has been identified, it's being seen, and it's still being driven further by the sledgehammers of this hyper progressive nonsense.
Well, and that's because humans are a hierarchical species. And in hierarchies, you know, which we naturally establish in all areas of our lives, that's what we do as, you know, human beings. Hierarchies cannot have necessarily competing authorities. You know, there's always an authority that kind of usurps the other authority, and there's a supreme authority above that. And so I think the problem parents pose to political ideologies that require you to kind of surrender all your authority is, how do you have a parent as an authority figure who may contradict the party, who may contradict the state's message? You can't. The only way you get above that is by putting the parent below kind of the ideology or the political authority. And so I think that parents' authority is naturally a threat.
What because, Hitler did.
Right. I mean, you just can't have it. You know, it all has to be kind of subsumed by the state.
And this is also why in a lot of cultural messaging, I believe that it's so quick to paint the father as the fool. So in a lot of sitcoms and a lot of family media, all the way down to like a book series, like the Berenstain Bears, you always see the father portrayed as the idiot, right? I mean, that's literally the theme of The Simpsons. So the father is the stupid fool and the mom is this all wise, you know, long suffering individual. Where now it's being pushed forward. So the mom is also a fool, and it's actually your teacher who's the all-wise, understanding individual. They get what you're going through. They're more educated than your stupid bumpkin parents. And what we're seeing is this long shift through from, once again, viewing your parents as the core of authority to the state is the authority. Yeah. And it is so resonant of what we have learned time and time again in the 20th century. Prussia learned it before its awkward, you know, collapse in the 17 and early 1800s. And really looking back through history, it is a common idea, as Frank said, for authority to usurp any other kind of authority in its presence.
Well, that's why people ask me, you know, on social media, why do I mock teachers and why do I ridicule them? And, you know, well, because I'm absolutely trying to bring them down to their kind of rightful place in authority. And I think that's kind of a tool of humor and irony and, you know, jesting with people is you're taking them down several pegs to where they belong. Teachers have been elevated to this almost place of, you know,
prophet.
No, there's no almost. They have been cemented. They have been dipped in gold,
yes,
and placed on the shelf as an idol of our society. And I'm speaking as someone who enjoys mm-hmm. teaching, yeah. who's worked with a lot of excellent teachers, but that doesn't mean I deserve your worship. No individual based on their status deserves your worship.
Yeah, that was my first blog post is where I kind of started all this, is describing them kind of as a priestly caste, and that's how they view themselves, and that's how we've been encouraged to view them. Mm-hmm.
We're coming to the end of our time, so I want to end with one question of all of you. Are there any dogmas that are present in American education today that Sowell missed back in 1993 when he wrote the book? Is there anything that comes to mind as being a new type of dogma that's come up in the past 10 or so years?
I would say this dogma that love is the ultimate virtue. And what I mean by that is love as described in a kind of naive child's like view of love, a human form that all the world needs and all children need and all everyone just needs is love and to be loved, and then things take care of themselves. And I'm not discrediting the importance of love or the role of love, but I think there are different levels of it. And
that's because there's true love, and then there's what this is, which isn't true and proper love.
Exactly. And there's also things that sometimes have to come before love. If you think of like with a family, like, yes, you love your family, but sometimes you have to do things born of sacrifice and born of what's in everyone's best interest.
Frank, Ramona, and Tony, thank you for joining me on the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
This has been episode 16 of the Genius of Thomas Sowell podcast. I'm Alan Wolin. Thanks for listening.